Item one, divided city, divided economy. Item two, just a touch of taxes. Item three, well, a little more taxes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 6th of December. Good as always to have you along, gang. President Trump made official this afternoon what had been rumored for days. He is going to recognize Jerusalem as the Israeli capital and start the process of moving the American embassy there from Tel Aviv. It's a decision, as you know, not without controversy in a region with enough divisions and disputes to go round. Divisions that are reflected in Jerusalem's economy, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains.
Jerusalem is a city that, despite regular conflict, still manages to keep functioning. In recent years, relative calm has allowed Israel's economy in general to improve, and some of that economic growth is visible in the capital. Real estate, for one, is booming. But
the important thing to know about the economy of Jerusalem is that it's a divided economy. The city is a divided city.
UCLA's Sari Makdisi says Palestinians living in Jerusalem's eastern districts often don't see the same benefits as the Jewish citizens in the west of the city. Those divisions show up in terms of who gets jobs and where improvements happen, or don't, says Natan Sachs at Brookings.
You're going to see the eastern part of the city, including in terms of infrastructure, lagging behind, and the ultra-Orthodox part of the city, there you're going to see lagging behind as well.
Many ultra-Orthodox Jews do not work traditional jobs, and Sachs says they're about 20-30% of the city's residents. Another third are Arab Israelis or Palestinians.
The Jerusalem economy might be the first part of the Israeli economy to be hit, in particular because it's the central topic of this whole morass that we might be entering.
Any protests or violence could deter tourism, a big industry in the Holy City, or make it a less desirable location for investment compared to the business hub of Tel Aviv. John Alterman is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says it will be a while before Trump's policy change starts to affect Jerusalem's economy.
I don't think any of this is happening soon. It takes, you know, years and years and years to build a new U.S. embassy, from acquiring the land to developing the plans to construction and everything else.
And that process is just beginning today. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The GOP's plans to rewrite the Internal Revenue Code took one step closer to getting President Trump's signature. Today, the Senate voted to form a conference committee with the House to hash out their differences, of which there are more than just a couple. Corporate America, as we've been telling you, is going to be the big winner in this process, whichever version of the bill you read. But not all corporations are treated equally, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
The centerpiece of the Republican plan is dropping the corporate tax rate from 35% to the low 20s.
So any profitable corporation will likely see some benefit, at least initially, from that.
That's Matt Gardner with the Nonpartisan Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. The plan especially helps companies that don't currently benefit from a lot of deductions, like retailers, which claim the highest effective tax rate of any industry, close to 35%, and banks. They pay about 29%. Quincy Crosby is chief market strategist at Prudential Financial.
The majority, especially the small and mid-cap banks, are domestically focused companies. And when the corporate tax rate comes down, they will be a primary beneficiary.
Another clear winner is commercial real estate, where President Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, have most of their investments. Both bills reduce the tax on income earned through so-called pass-through businesses. Michael Knoll teaches law at the University of Pennsylvania.
So that's a substantial reduction in tax rate, and that's going to apply pretty broadly. And most real estate is held through pass-through entities of some sort.
Commercial real estate companies are also exempt from new limits on certain deductions faced by other businesses. The impact on the tech industry is less clear. Tech companies already pay a relatively low effective rate of just 18.5%, but they would benefit from a provision allowing them to bring back cash stockpiled overseas at a low tax rate. How well companies fare could depend on how well they game the new system. Which leads us to another big winner, the accounting industry. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Today in labor management relations, the National Football League, the league's owners announced today they have signed a new contract with Commissioner Roger Goodell, 5-year deal with a possible per annum compensation of $40 million. That's per annum every year, which is a lot, right? Not so much when you consider Aetna CEO Mark Bertolini. If and when the deal to sell Aetna to CVS closes, Bertolini could walk away with $500 million, with a B, in total compensation. That's stock options, shares he owns, and a change of control package as well. Ticker symbol AET, up 0.1% today. That is Aetna. The three major indices, kind of a split decision. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Type the letters BTCUSD into the search engine of your choice today, and you are going to see a big number come back at you. Five figures, starts with 13. It's the Bitcoin dollar exchange rate, and it's just about $13,000 to a Bitcoin at the moment, up $1,000 in the past 24 hours. Setting aside the volatility for a minute, what do you suppose you would do if somebody had given you some Bitcoin a couple of years ago? Ben Eisen of the Wall Street Journal found himself in exactly that dilemma, so we called him up to talk about it. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Give us your Bitcoin saga in a nutshell then, would you?
Sure. So I received a Bitcoin as a wedding gift from a friend who had been into the cryptocurrency, and this was in mid-2015, and held on to it for about a year and a half, sold part of it. Mid last year, after the price had started rising, and then after the price rose a bit more, sold the rest of it at the end of last year.
For how much? Like $1,000, right?
Just below $1,000, and then the price just started surging right after I sold it.
It is now. I'm sitting here looking at my monitor. It's $12,870 per Bitcoin as we speak. Which raises a whole bunch of questions, and I want to throw them at you. The first of all, is Bitcoin a currency, do you think, or is it just speculation at this point?
Well, it's interesting. It's it was designed as a currency, as sort of a stateless currency that's not beholden specifically to one government or monetary system. And it started to develop like that, but it's developed as an investment much quicker. You're starting to see a bunch of mainstream investors get into the market, and a couple of exchanges are about to launch futures contracts on Bitcoin as a way of actually paying for stuff, not quite as fast.
Yeah, the mechanics of it are still a little tricky, but it does have, the total market cap, if you will, of Bitcoin out there is bigger than some, big companies in this economy. It's a force.
Yeah, absolutely. It's bigger than General Electric, a bunch of other blue chip companies. It's really gigantic. And there's other cryptocurrencies as well that bring the value of something like over $300 billion in market cap.
Do you believe that this is a bubble at $13,000 a pop?
I mean, it's really hard to say. I think bubbles are usually kind of determined in hindsight. Just looking at the way the price has gone up, it definitely seems to mirror certain other bubbles that we've seen in the past.
It is not yet clear what the, I guess, the regulatory framework will be for Bitcoin, right? I mean, the SEC has been looking at this. The Fed, I know, is concerned about it. We don't know yet what the rules are going to be, do we?
No, it's very new. It's moved a lot quicker than the regulatory bodies that typically look at this stuff. That said, there have been something called initial coin offerings, which is sort of an alternative to an initial public offering, and that's a market that's kind of gotten pretty big pretty quickly, and the SEC has started cracking down with some enforcement cases on that. So perhaps that's one area where we could see a little bit more regulation coming.
You did all right on the wedding gift you got, right? You say you tripled your money?
Something like that, almost tripled the money. It paid off better than the stock market, for sure.
Yeah. You say that your buddy who got you this, he just got married and you got him a 30-year treasury note, right?
I did, yeah.
Now, the question is, and you asked this in your piece, which one's going to be worth more in 30 years, Bitcoin or the 30-year note?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's hard to tell. Treasury notes, they pay very low interest, but they accumulate over a long period of time. This has paid out a lot quicker, but remains to be seen what will happen 30 years from now.
Ben Eisen at the Wall Street Journal. Ben, thanks a lot.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
We do a thing every now and then, a series called My Economy, people's stories about how their own personal economies are going. There are business economies out there that matter as well, though, big ones and small ones. Today's installment comes from an industry that has been under some pressure.
I'm James Fox Smith. I'm publisher of Country Roads Magazine, which is a regional independent media publication covering the cultural life of South Louisiana. Business is surprisingly good. Perhaps the reason that our particular kind of media is doing better than some of the national and international printed products is that we have a very closely defined interest area. And there is still something that the internet doesn't do very well, which is provide people with well-curated local information about a product or an interest or an area of interest that is particularly important to them. Now, I mean, if we go back to 2012, 2013, at the time when particularly the digital media audience was growing exponentially, and particularly the transition to mobile, where a lot of media was moving and a lot of the audience was moving to a mobile environment, that was a very difficult transition for a lot of small independent media to make. It really wasn't clear to us how we would respond to those changes and evolve in a way that served our readers as well as we could do on paper. My resume when we came to this was thin to the point of emaciated. I was a pretty good dishwasher. I was quite a good ski bum. And beyond that, I hadn't had a whole lot of experience. My wife has always very much felt that she could never imagine working for somebody else after 22 years of doing this for ourselves. And I think at this point, I scarcely can either.
Business or personal, tell us how things are going for you. There is a place you can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
I got to pay taxes, 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 taxes. And it seems like that's all I do.
Taxes, 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 the Texas way. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 39 points today, about a 10th percent, 24,140 on the blue chips. NASDAQ up 14 points, 2/10 percent, a neatly palindromic 67.76. S&P 500 lost less than a point, basically flat there. McDonald's is expanding its dollar menu with offerings priced at $1, $2, and $3, which means it's not really a dollar menu, is it? Also bringing back those buttermilk chicken tenders that got rave reviews and then inexplicably disappeared, like the McRib. McDonald's shares up 2/10 percent today. Wendy's off about 2 percent. Home Depot announced a $15 billion share buyback program, said it's going to invest in supply chain and delivery networks. The home improvement store's shares were down 1.1% on the news. Rival Lowe's had a much harder day. Its shares dropped 4.5% today. Google said it's pulling YouTube from some Amazon devices in retaliation for Amazon refusing to sell Google products. Alphabet, Google's parent, rose 1.2% today. Amazon climbed 0.9%. You're listening to Marketplace. Here's an investment opportunity with a guaranteed return. When you donate to support Marketplace today, your gift is going to be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at Candida. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than help keep the show on the air. You help us grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. So please don't miss out on this chance to make your donation go twice as far. Give today at marketplace.org, and thanks.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Bob Iger, it seems, may never leave his job running Disney. CNBC reports today that Iger is considering staying beyond his already extended departure date of 2019 to facilitate Disney's rumored acquisition of key parts of Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox empire, specifically the entertainment bits, movies and television studios, both here and internationally. Fox, it appears, would keep its news, sports and broadcast networks. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has the story.
Just the prospect of a Disney-Fox merger has got some superfans geeking out. On YouTube, they've already uploaded mashups showing what it'd look like if Disney's Avengers and Fox's X-Men fought alongside each other. By buying Fox's movie and TV studios, Disney would be able to beef up its content, says Robin Diedrich, an analyst at Edward Jones.
They gain some of that talent. They gain some of those physical assets. But they also gain that library of existing content.
And Disney wants all of that, she says, because it plans to join the Netflix and Amazon club. In 2019, it is launching a streaming service.
It is in response to, you know, a need to compete on that type of platform.
And a deal with Fox would give Disney an even bigger stake in Hulu, about 60%. Tuna Amobi, an analyst with CFRA Research, says a consolidation would generate tremendous cost savings for Disney.
Seems like the game right now, it's all about getting bigger and economies of scale.
But Rich Greenfield, an analyst with BTIG, says Disney would be investing in the wrong place and that buying traditional cable networks like National Geographic and FX doesn't make sense.
The best way to do it would be to invest in content that isn't tied to the legacy cable distribution systems. They're basically buying more assets that have long-term challenges facing them.
In the short term, one of Disney's biggest challenges, if it in fact does buy Fox, will be to make sure the government doesn't block it. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
This past January, residents of the town of Carrollton, Ohio, population 3,135, showed up at their local grocery store to find the doors locked and a sign that read simply, "Store closed." It was the only dedicated grocery store in a county of nearly 28,000 people, making Carrollton and its surroundings a food desert, places where big chunks of the population don't have access to a grocery store. Usually, those are poorer, more urban neighborhoods. But according to the Department of Agriculture, about 15% of food deserts in this country aren't in the big cities. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra has that one.
The former grocery store in Carrollton, Ohio, looks like your typical creepy abandoned building. It's dark inside. It's boarded up with moldy wood. Carrollton is in eastern Ohio's Carroll County, about a 40-minute drive from Canton. The county's economic development director, Tate Carter, is peering through the doors of the 30,000-square-foot building. She says the place shut down abruptly.
The electric company came and shut the electric off, and all of the food was still left in all the coolers. So I don't even want to imagine what it smelled like in there.
This store was owned by Thorne's Market, a local grocery chain founded in 1972. The company closed its four stores in January and disconnected its phone. The owners haven't given a reason.
I think they've been struggling for a while.
Even before Thorne's closed, Carroll County was a food desert. In rural places, that's a low-income area where at least 500 people, or a third of the population, live more than 10 miles from the nearest supermarket or large grocery store. About 4.5 million Americans live in rural food deserts, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Julia Koprak is a senior associate at a nonprofit called the Food Trust. It works with towns that have lost a grocery store. She says the problem is everywhere.
In the Mississippi Delta, in rural Kansas, in upstate New York, in every rural community across the country, you're hearing about a food access challenge.
Koprak says there are long-standing reasons, like falling populations in rural towns. But things have also gotten harder for local grocers lately. Over the past year, Walmart has been lowering its prices to compete with Amazon and with discount supermarket chains. Scott Mushkin at Wolf Research says that's led to price wars that hurt small grocers.
If you have supermarkets in a rural area and you're finding yourself, because Walmart decides to sell milk for 76 cents a gallon and eggs at, you know, 44 cents, now all of a sudden you have to compete against that. You're going to be just losing money hand over fist.
And if you don't cut prices, your customers might buy their groceries online or drive to the nearest Walmart that sells them. There's one about 40 minutes from Carrollton. Once a town's only grocery store closes, residents are left with few options. In Carrollton, people end up shopping at discount stores like Dollar General Market. It carries some basic fresh foods like apples, bananas, and potatoes. Gail Rizzoletti, who's 62, is pushing a cart through the frozen foods section. She rattles off the items on her list that she can't buy here.
Big tubs of plain yogurt, all kinds of cheeses. You can't buy any kind of a hard Parmesan wedge or anything like that. You know, it has to just be the powdered stuff. No one carries it. Good olive oil.
To get those groceries, Rizzoletti drives to a supermarket in Minerva, about half an hour away.
Personally, I can't stand not having a grocery store in town. And I think a whole lot of people feel the same way.
Other places that have lost a grocery store have come up with creative workarounds. A student-run grocery store in Nebraska, a public-private supermarket in Kansas. Tate Carter has been trying to bring a new grocery store to Carrollton. Recently, she tried to woo the discount grocery chain Aldi. A local realtor knows the CEO.
I was like, perfect. See what you can find out for me. That would be, you know, great if they want to come visit the property and check things out.
But she says Aldi told her it won't open a store unless at least 50,000 people live in the area. Carroll County's entire population is just over half that.
So we're still trying, but it's tough. We just don't meet those numbers.
And Carter says she can't just snap her fingers and make tens of thousands of people appear in the county, especially not without a grocery store. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
In central Texas, about an hour west of Austin, is a community called Horseshoe Bay. It's mostly retirees living along Lake LBJ, right on the edge of Burnett and Llano counties, both of which voted 75% in favor of President Trump last year. Why am I telling you all that? I'm telling you because Andy Euler went out there to find out what folks think of the tax bill.
There's a bit of a wait to get a table at Julie's Cocina on a weekday just after noon. The place has been here since 2009, and the waitstaff knows the regulars by name. The bartender, Nina, takes me over to one loyal customer perched on a chair, a vocal Trump supporter.
My name is Leon Fuller. I work at Horseshoe Bay Veterinarian Clinic.
He's got faith in the tax bill.
You know, I hope it does pass, and I hope we do get some money back to the middle class, which is all it's going to do is turn around and make our economy stronger.
Retired marketing and sales rep Frank Hosia is a little more cautious.
It's way too early. Between the Senate and Congress, they're going to have so many different reiterations of this. So anything we think about that we know, don't.
But he does think the tax system needs an overhaul. He voted for Trump and thinks the bet on trickle-down is a good one.
Having the highest corporate tax rate in the world makes no sense. We're seeing the amount of jobs that are leaving the country and have been leaving the country. Let's figure out how to bring the monies back to the country as well as the jobs back to the country.
Just a couple miles down the road in another little town, Marble Falls, I stop in at the R Bar.
I'm Nadine Rader. I'm from Marble Falls, and I'm a server at Noon Spoon Cafe. I'm 25.
She didn't vote in last year's presidential election.
I'm a single mom of two, so I'll get two child credits back at the end of the year, and that's not going up for me. But as far as somebody who, let's say, is making $150,000 in the home, they're going to get more money back than me, who is below $20,000 a year, just barely making it with two kids, single mom. So, I mean, yes, they are putting in more money into the system, but no, it's not helping me.
Across the street is Bill's Burgers, where Roland Parker's grabbing a beer. He's a self-employed cabinet maker. He also didn't vote in the presidential election. He says even with no state income tax in Texas, he still feels burdened by taxes.
It seems like from when I get any money from an individual to work to when I finally wrap it up and then at the end of the quarter, it seems like I pay taxes three times. I got to pay taxes, 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 taxes. And it seems like that's all I do.
Back at Julie's Cocina, the crowd has thinned out, but there are still a few folks eating today's enchilada special.
My name is Adolf Perez. I install retractable screen doors for Phantom Screens. I'm really not that much concerned about it because what control do you have? We already voted people in, and those people are going to do whatever they want because that's how it is. You can tell me you're going to do this, you're going to do that as a politician, and once you get there, the money starts rolling in and you forget what you told me.
Like the majority of folks in this part of Central Texas, Perez voted for the president. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I guess it's all in the details. Walmart announced today it's changing its name. It's subtle, though, so listen up. From Wal, hyphen capital M, Mart stores, to just plain Walmart, capital W, lowercase m, all one word. Said CEO Doug McMillon, capital M, lowercase c, capital M, we felt it was best to have a name that was consistent with the idea that you can shop us however you like as a customer, not just in stores. All right, we are out of here. The Dow off 39 points today, about a 10%. NASDAQ up 14 points, about 0.2% there. S&P 500 basically flat. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.